With the state of today's economy, it is more important than ever to invest in products that last for years to come. As the seasons shift and get cooler, make sure your closet is stocked with durable layers that stand the test of time from American Giant. American Giant's clothes work harder and are wearable season after season. Their greatest hoodie ever made is made of the highest quality materials that are cut and sewn right here in the United States. So you're investing right back into your local community. Choosing American Giant means taking a stand for American manufacturing and hardworking Americans, something other mega corporations don't care about. From fleece to knit, all in a range of colors for versatile daily wear, American Giant delivers everyday pieces designed for everyday life. Feel the difference of quality made-to-last clothes from American Giant. Get 20% off your first order with code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with code STAPLE20.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with Gregory Copley, editor and publisher of Defense and Foreign Affairs. We leave West Africa and we go to the Philippine Islands, the South China Sea. Video shows China blasting water cannon, reports the New York Times, at Philippines Coast Guard boat. This situation is called the Second Thomas Shoals. It's well within the exclusive economic zone of the Philippines. In any event, China is using its so-called Coast Guard to harass a boat that is marooned or tied to and not moving since World War II, I believe, where the Filipino forces have maintained watch because the Chinese have a way of taking away property if you don't guard it. This is the Second Thomas Shoals. It's part of the larger story of the South China Sea and the Nine Dash Line. Gregory, the reason I go to the Philippines is not to settle this dispute, but also to introduce your newest essay about Xi and his aggression, especially towards Taiwan, but really towards the whole region. Using water cannon to harass the Filipino forces is provocative, but it's more of the same wolf warrior turned into military affairs. Does Xi want a military confrontation, or is he satisfied with the bluffing of water cannons?
Well, he has to be content with the bluffing through the water cannon diplomacy or water cannon offensive. He's been doing it for some time with the Chinese Coast Guard, which is actually a navy of its own. But it can be deployed as though it were a civilian force, a force to protect domestic waterways. The Chinese Coast Guard has frigate and destroyer-sized vessels. They've been using water cannon and ramming techniques against Taiwanese Navy vessels and Taiwanese Coast Guard vessels along the Straits of Taiwan, and particularly around the Taiwanese islands close to the Chinese mainland. So this has been underway for a while. And I think it serves Xi Jinping to be able to do this, to show that he is flexing his muscles, he is not backing down. He must know by now that he has lost the battle to coerce the Philippines back into line. During the Obama administration in the U.S., President Obama had so alienated the president of the Philippines that he did, for a period, talk very in friendly terms to Beijing. That's all over. The Philippines are back attempting to portray themselves as the legal heirs to much of the waterways in the Nine Dash Line area of the South China Sea. They have an international court ruling in their favor on this. So what Xi is doing is merely attempting to show that he is virile and flexible, not only to the international community in the Philippines. He's doing that to demonstrate to the Chinese public that he is in charge, and that the Communist Party of China and the People's Republic of China are moving forward as the inevitable great power of the world, which is the reverse of the truth.
You present this irony that Xi is establishing in the People's Republic of China a war mentality, and yet he lacks the fundamental, the war economy. Please explain.
Well, in fact, the headline to that report was, "Xi, without a strategy or an economic philosophy, promises war without a war economy." If you're going to fight a war, you need to, and a serious war for survival, then you need to marshal your forces in such a way that you have all of the elements working toward your national victory. What's happened in the People's Republic of China is they don't have that. The economy, which Xi inherited, was a national socialist economy, for want of a better words, where you had a private sector which was designed under Deng Xiaoping to basically open up Chinese productivity and also to attract foreign investment. And it did that to a great degree. However, it's really an economy which is controlled heavily by the Communist Party. And increasingly, since Xi Jinping took office in 2012, he's tried to get rid of much of the private sector and to once again favor the state-owned enterprises, which contributed zero to the great economic growth of mainland China over the past 20 years. So now you see him trying to stimulate that so-called quasi-market economy by Wall Street-type interventions, stimulating investment, stimulating the housing market and so on, all of which are failing comprehensively because it is not truly a market-driven operation, particularly since the removal of foreign trade. China is not exporting substantially on the international market anymore. It's not getting the input of foreign investment anymore. It is really seeing its whole economy collapse, and it seems that Xi Jinping and the Communist Party can do nothing about it. They're every day adopting small band-aid measures to keep the economy going, to perhaps restart some faith in the housing market, which is, that's not going to work. That's gone. That train has left the station, and most Chinese people are seeing that their retirement savings have all been wasted on building programs which never were completed, and homes which were unsaleable and the like. And you've got a population in China which has, well, they're talking about 24% unemployment among the youth. In fact, we're looking at an overall national unemployment level of maybe 50%. It is absolutely astronomical, the level of unemployment. The current and recent year and particularly recent weeks of major natural disasters, including mass floodings and the like, have been seen as omens, auguries of public rejection of his leadership, that Xi has lost the mandate of heaven, and that therefore this presages an end to his reign as emperor.
You know,
so what's
you
know, he
do
about
Gregory,
it?
That his power base is the PLA. Is that still true?
Mm. No, that's not true. And in fact, he saw firsthand in recent weeks that the PLA itself was preparing to quietly resist attempts to get them to fight a war over Taiwan. This is a war that they know they cannot win, not because they can't absolutely destroy life, all life on the island of Taiwan, but because if they do, there'll be a number of things which will occur. There'll be wars on all of China's borders, particularly with Vietnam, most particularly with India and in the Tibetan plateau. There'll be if Taiwan is attacked, Japan will support Taiwan. The U.S. will then be drawn in. South Korea will then be drawn in, and so on. So the PLA knows that this is not going to have any good outcomes. And at the very, very least, what would happen if the PLA went to war against Taiwan is that the Republic of China, the Taiwanese armed forces, could, with relative impunity, destroy the Three Gorges Dam, which would flood Beijing, Shanghai, and the like, and cause hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions of deaths, and certainly would destroy the economy. They would be able to, with relative impunity, destroy the major shipyards in northern areas of China, around Dalian and so on, where the carriers must go if they're to get support. That will be all gone. So basically, the PLA would be destroyed for no benefit. So what does the PLA do about it? And we discussed in the last weeks how Xi Jinping has been replacing some of the senior leaders of the key military commands, particularly the strategic rocket forces, where he took out the top two officers and apparently went down to another level of removing officers, allegedly for corruption, which is the standard approach. Now what he's doing is trying to pull away from threatening the PLA, which he knows now is not under control, and he is now threatening a new round of COVID-19. He's saying, "Whoa, hang on, there's another lot of COVID-19 which is about to take place. So we have to build a whole lot of hospitals, new hospitals. We have to drive the zero COVID campaign once again." So this is an effort to divert away from the problem with the PLA and to divert the PLA into supporting him in suppressing the domestic population rather than in fighting against Taiwan. Now, Xi has painted himself into a corner. He can't now go back and say, well, we won't attack Taiwan, because he promised that he would re-deliver Taiwan into the Chinese family. In fact, communist China never had control of Taiwan anyway, but the best he could do on the Taiwan question is wait until the January elections in Taiwan, which will possibly remove the DPP, the current ruling party, from office in the presidency of Taiwan, and re-elect a leader from the Kuomintang, the Nationalist Party. And Xi could, you know, if he could stop blushing while he said it, could say that this is a victory. It's taken away the independence-minded DPP, and declare that as a victory and stave off the need for an attack on Taiwan. But the reality is he needs now to control his domestic population, which is facing enormous unrest. The Chinese people have resisted an incredible, an unprecedented amount of surveillance and suppression, and are still protesting. This is an enormous display of courage by those Chinese people, knowing that the state has enormous powers of suppression and repression. So all of this is going on while Beijing is facing the secret hostility of Russia. We saw the war in Ukraine and the subsequent Western sanctions against Russia force Russia into an alliance with Beijing once again. But that really covers up or papers over the deep and abiding competition between Beijing and Moscow over territory, over legitimacy, and over technology.
And I want to ask about that, Gregory. Is China capable of moving on the north, moving on Russia and claiming that rich resources of Siberia? Is that within Xi's playbook?
It's definitely within his playbook, and he's already telegraphed that. He said that Vladivostok, the great Russian port city in the Far East, was really still a Chinese territory, even though it had been legally ceded by earlier imperial governments to Russia in the 19th century. So that basically is something he could do, but he would find that he'd face enormous Russian retaliation on that. And this is one area where the Russians, and before them the Soviets, actually planned extensively for the use of tactical and theater ballistic nuclear weapons. And that could happen because the same restriction, if you like, on the use of nuclear weapons between Russia and the NATO or Russia and any other Western power really doesn't hold for the Russia-China conflict. In any event, I think if Xi attempted even to take over the Russian Far East, including Vladivostok, he would probably fail because the PLA almost certainly would not support that either.
Gregory Copley, editor and publisher of Defense and Foreign Affairs. A war economy does not exist at this point. The economy itself is tattered. By all reports from Bloomberg and from people who watch the metrics, the disappointment in China is evident. We're going to turn to our favorite segment of the week, the King Charles III Report, because Charles is in Scotland enjoying himself. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.